Paul Steinhauser reporting nationally for Fox News and us as well. Good morning, New Hampshire, the Pulse of NH on this Monday morning. Steiny.
Hey, good morning, Jack. And you and I are old enough to remember when Jimmy Valvano won that national championship back in 83 with that razor-thin win over Houston. I was J-Dog, you're a little younger, but that was a big, big game. Hey, and also, I'm a BU guy, so very happy that my Terriers are back in the Frozen Four for the second year in a row. Maybe we can win in the semis and face off against BC. Wouldn't that be nice, an all-New England final there, BU-BC? Let's hope that happens. But I know you want me to talk presidential politics.
I'll talk
President
hockey.
Trump. That's it. Never a bad time.
You know why? You know why? There's plenty of smash mouth and hitting in both.
Oh, isn't that the truth, my friend? And let me tell you, this week, former President Trump's going to do something he may not be able to do again for a while, Jack. He's going to be on the campaign trail tomorrow. He's going to Michigan, and I'll be out there for him on that one. And then he goes to Wisconsin, two really thin, razor-thin battleground states that Joe Biden won 4 years ago to win the White House. But Trump has not been on the campaign trail much, and he probably won't going forward, at least during the week, because remember, that first trial starts in 2 weeks. That's really going to derail him. So what he does today may be something, or tomorrow is something he won't be able to do much going forward. The other big political story, of course, we got a wide open race now, we think, in the second congressional district here in New Hampshire after Andy Custer calling it quits, going to retire.
Yeah, and already we're hearing some names, not surprising, some maybe a little surprising, but it's going to be interesting. You're definitely going to have a couple of Democrats running. My guess is Colin Van Ostern, Andrew Walensky, former executive counselor. Republicans are going to think you're going to see some names that you've seen before in that race, and who knows, maybe others. But I'm saying is both sides going to be contested, Paul.
Wide open race on both sides. You're absolutely right. Colin Van Ostern already in. Maybe he got a heads up because he announced the very next day. Looked a little fishy there, didn't it?
Yeah.
But Andrew Walensky, sources tell me that he is getting calls. People are urging him to run. He's seriously thinking about it. There's definitely going to be a candidate on the left on the Democratic side. And yeah, on the Republican side, maybe does George Hansel run again? Does Bob Burns run again? Now that it's an open seat, the Republicans think, well, maybe we have a shot this time because it was almost impossible to beat Andy Custer when she was running. But she's not this time.
And then the question, Paul, I think you're going to have three or four Republicans in the primary. Regardless of who wins the primary, can a Republican win that second congressional district? That's the other question.
It's been a long time, right?
Yeah.
2010 was the last time a Republican won that district. And, it is a blue district now. But without the incumbent running, it becomes a little more, a little more competitive.
Thank you, Paul.
Have a good one, Jack.
Michael Graham, NHJournal.com, New Hampshire Journal. A lot to talk about. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Did you see Senator Donna Soucy on WMUR this weekend?
Sorry to say I missed that one, Michael.
You missed? No, it's definitely worth watching. She reiterated the Democrats' opposition to increased immigration enforcement and their support for sanctuary cities in New Hampshire, despite what's going on in Massachusetts. We'll get to that in a second. But the thing that the comment she made that's got the most attention from our NHJournal.com readers is she was trying to explain why she thinks it's okay for biological males to compete against girls in K-12 sports. And the first thing she said is that trans girls, which is a man, are girls. So the first thing she said is that boys are girls. But the second thing she said is, and look what's happening in the NCAA. And this is a direct quote, Jack. The leading scorer in the NCAA is not a man, but a woman, which, of course, is true. Jack, what do you know about what's her name? Chris Kringle, I forget her name. The leading scorer in the NCAA basketball tournament right now.
Well, if it's I don't know if it's the one that from Iowa. You mean the
What do you know about her?
Oh, I know she's a phenomenal basketball. She's the best. I mean, she's doing great.
Who does she play against in every single game?
Women.
Women, only women. So
you know what's sad?
I don't understand the point.
You know what's sad?
Senator Susie's trying to make. You know, the best scorer in sports is a woman when she plays against women. Therefore, why not have guys play? You don't want to be mean-spirited because, and I apologize for not knowing her name, I don't follow women's basketball, but the fact is, if she played in the NCAA men's, she would be on the bench.
Here's the other point,
biology,
though.
Not because of will or talent or value. It's just biology. So there you go.
But here's the other point, Michael. Yesterday, whether or not you were celebrating Easter, 9.8% of the people don't want to talk about transgender rights in sports right now on Sunday. That's not what they wanted to talk about yesterday.
I agree. And also, this is another thing from a purely political, because as you know, at NHL.com, we are all about the sports of politics. We're not as interested in the individual, you know, who wins, who loses, as much as the game. We like watching the game. If I were Joe Biden and I were really trying to get Republicans who were disenfranchised with Donald Trump to come over and support me, I would not observe Transgender Day of whatever on Easter. I would say, you know what, this year we're going to do it on Saturday or Monday or Tuesday. Right. Yep. You know, they can do it whenever they want. He's not a, you know, he's not an employee. He's the president of the United States. That would have been the smart move.
Right.
But, and instead they chose not to. And I think that's one of the problems that Biden's going to have throughout this year is every day he makes people who are saying, I could never vote for Donald Trump, say, maybe I could vote for Donald Trump.
Look at if Joe Biden and his advisors, because his advisors are some of the most politicized political I've ever seen. I'm not saying that in politics, but they're incredibly agenda driven. If they want to double down and declare this day of transgender recognition, whatever, on Easter Sunday, and they want to double down on the border, thinking that most people don't care about undocumented migrants who commit crimes here not being detained, go ahead. Keep doing that all day long and see where it gets you.
And for people who haven't read NHL.com, shame on you. You should go there right now and sign up for our newsletter. We have a piece about the reporting on Friday. Five illegal immigrants were arrested in the greater Boston area. Lynn, the city itself, you know, the surrounding environs, for those of us who used to live there, know it very well. And all five of them have one thing in common.
I was born there, Michael.
In Lynn?
Yeah, City of Sin.
The City of Sin?
Yeah, that's, I heard it all my life growing up, yep.
The way you come out, is it the way you went in?
My late-grandmother, Heath, used to say, tell friends and family that you were born at Salem Hospital. I said, no, I was born in Lynn. Played hockey in Lynn. If you get out of both and survived, you're at the Wynn Arena, it's not there anymore. You're okay. You're
well,
tough.
Well, I lived in lovely Hopkinton, Mass., a great town. My kids got a great education there, but it is full of crazy people. And so what happened in Massachusetts is these five different illegal immigrants are not in a gang or anything. They're unrelated. They were all arrested, four of them for sexual assault on a minor, three of them for sexual assaults on minors under the age of 14. And all of them were released by Massachusetts court systems because of their sanctuary city policies. And so all five, the fifth was an MS-13 gang member, were rounded up this past week. Bill Malugin with Fox News, and you can hate Fox News, you can, you know, say they're politically biased, they clearly are, but Malugin is a good reporter. He's always had the numbers, always had the stats, and he was right there with them, and the head of the local, they call it the ERO office, it's the one that goes out and grabs the illegal immigrants who are
Much familiar with it,
He said, look, we have to make a decision every day. Do we arrest the child predator, or do we arrest the repeat fentanyl offender? We don't have the resources to do both. And what that tells me, Jack, is not the resources part. It's the volume of criminals who are also in violation of immigration law who are in the Boston area. They don't have enough people to arrest all of the dangerous immigrants.
And also,
so
sanctuary.
With that on the border, Joyce Craig says, I'll take sanctuary cities. Cindy Warmington says, I'll take sanctuary cities. The candidates in second congressional district say, I'll take sanctuary cities. And who knows, like you just said, what impact will that have?
This is all sanctuary city stuff. You know what? If Governor Healey and folks are so adamant about sanctuary cities, why don't they adopt that MS whatever gang? Why don't they adopt a few of these young guys who are intent on raping minors if they're so hell-bent on their rights? Why don't they adopt a few?
Well, let me remind your listeners, Jack, the state of Massachusetts has already asked family, will you please adopt an illegal?
No, I'm saying, why doesn't Governor Healey start at the top?
But this is my point. She's asking her citizens to adopt illegals, and among them are four child rapists and an MS-13.
Let's start with you, Governor. Bleeding Heart, why don't you adopt a few? Lead the way, Governor Healey. The way. Michael, be real quickly, NHL.com.
Sure.
Second Congressional District, Colin Van Ostern, Andrew Walensky. But I'm hearing three or four Republican names.
I don't think Andrew Walensky is going to run. So just, you heard that here first. So watch for somebody else. A lot of people are high on Becky Whitley. Kayla Montgomery with New Hampshire, with Planned Parenthood Northern New England, very articulate spokesperson. And
I'm telling you, Van Ostern is already almost in this thing.
No, I know Colin is in. Colin's in. I'm saying yep. Andrew Walensky not. Oh, okay. I would be very surprised if he ends up running. Now, okay. I don't know anything definitive, but based on the sources I've spoken to, a lot of people want him to run because they want a true progressive in that race. I don't know it's going to be him. It could be Becky, like I said, Becky Whitley, who's, by the way, is in D.C. right now. You know what you can do when you're done with the Easter eggs in D.C., Jack? You can go meet with PAC groups and leaders, et cetera. So we'll see. On the Republican side, Bob Burns told a competing radio station he is virtually all in. I'm hearing he's going to announce this week. There's a business person, William Hamlin from Hanover. He was a commodities trader, real estate guy. He's apparently very, very serious about getting in. I would expect him to announce this week. Lily Tang Williams, who's been on your show, she's in, been campaigning hard. State Senator Kerry Gendro, who's probably not going to be running for state mm-hmm. senate again, it could run. And then Vikram Mansuramani, U.S. Senate candidate, very smart, very sharp. He also is a regular on a certain radio station, Jack.
Yeah, and I wasn't aware we had competition. But anyway, go ahead.
His name has been bandied about as well. But it's just going to be very tough. We have a piece that we posted last week. If you look at the record, since 2006, Democrats have won it by an average of 9.3 points. Since 2016, which is when all politics changed, anyone who's looking at stuff pre-2016 they're on a different planet, because Trump hit on 2016, and then you started to feel the effects in 2018. And since then, Democrats have carried it by 10 points. Biden won the district by 9 or 10 points. Even Colin Van Ostern, running for governor back in 2016, won the second congressional district, and widely agreed, not a great candidate. So it's a very, very Democratic district. When Governor Sununu says he didn't want to change the maps because he didn't want to give the Democrats a permanent seat, well, they pretty much already have one. So that's a tough race for the Republicans.
All right, Michael, thank you. Make it a great start to your week. Doug Tangdon, worldmarketadvisors.com, checking in with an economic update. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great, Jack. You are a cipher. Here you're quoting Canterbury Tales. You joke about Lin Lin's City of Sin, but you must have studied literature up at UVM.
A little bit. Hey, Doug, you're going to get another little bonanza here midweek. You know, keep those keep your skis out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the tracks going up and down 89, if you're going up and down 89, Whaleback it's not open, but there's plenty of people going up and down.
Yeah, it's fun to go get a workout. Folks. Yeah, go get a workout.
Yeah.
Skin up. Hey, Doug, on the economic front, I mean, there's so much politics. It's too much sometimes. Everything's politicized, but what are we catching? I know that's interesting on this Baltimore bridge collapse, because I've heard from people, structural type engineers, I'm thinking if it takes a year to build a really nice home these days, I'm thinking how long? But I'm hearing they're going to get this bridge back together faster than we think, which is amazing to me. But I get it if the columns are intact. But beyond that, are supply chains interruptions? You know, that's a big busy port there in Baltimore. A lot of stuff has to be rerouted.
Yeah, the rule of thumb is that economic growth can be delayed but not denied here. This is a disruption that may create some backlogs that then get made up in another quarter. This will not be a permanent change in the structure of the economy, because the economic infrastructure has not been permanently degraded. I'll tell you what degrades economic infrastructure is raising marginal taxes that gets in the way of commerce. That degrades our infrastructure, but this will be a temporary up and down. It's not a big deal.
All right, what else is catching your eye on this Monday morning?
Well, two things. First of all, this is a big data week. We will get non-farm payrolls at the end of the month. That's probably the most important economic indicator. We'll get some stuff in the interim. We'll get some indicators that may or may not confirm the slight slowdown that we're seeing. And then, of course, I'm looking at interest rates as you are, and it's interesting that while mortgage rates dip below 7% for a brief period of time, they're back up, you know, 7.25% or so. I do expect that the Fed is going to begin easing rates either in June or July, and they'll just keep going. Somebody asked me over the weekend, Do you like Jay Powell? I'm like, well, it doesn't really matter whether I like him. Well, do you think he's political? You think he, I don't think he has a political bone in his body. I think he's simply doing what he sees to be the right thing. I personally think they should have eased rates 3 months ago and said, okay, we lowered them once, now leave us alone. We are on the path to ease. Then go ahead and do whatever you want to do. But that's, you know, that's just my opinion. That's not the rest of the Fed. The rest of the Fed is saying, we're just going to keep rates here for as long as we need to. My fear, Jack, is that they'll keep them there longer than they need to, and that'll slow the economy unnecessarily.
Interesting. Any other, what else? I mean, I think we're in this period, a lot of people focusing on tax returns, you know, coming up mid-month.
Yep. Yep, taxes are a big deal. You know, I've said thank you multiple times to Chris Christie for lowering the interest and dividends tax. New Hampshire will very soon join the list of states that are on the no income tax list. We're not on that list because, of course, we have that interest and dividends tax, but it is going away not next year. Next year. This year it's down to 3%, and then it goes to zero.
You know, it's interesting, Doug. You are not far. You know, Vermont's a beautiful state. I was talking to someone about this, and I can't think of what they're, but did you read Governor Sununu Ray's a week or two ago? He was pointing out that Vermont legislature, despite the governor's opposition, which means it might be vetoed, is moving forward with plans to raise that upper tier income tax level to 11.5% on state income tax for couples
just
making.
Incredible. It's incredible. That's like 1% of Vermont taxpayers would pay that. And they imagine that that they don't have options. Of course people have options. They can move. I just want to go back to the interest and dividends tax. Some of your listeners may not know. They might end up, because rates have risen so much, people might end up owing money to the state of New Hampshire. Just check it out. Go to nh.gov and check out the form DP10 just to make sure that you don't owe something, because it might end up being only a couple hundred bucks, but you got to make sure that you file it.
So, yeah, it's interesting. And if you listen to the show, I went to UVM. Bernie Sanders was mayor, so maybe the state is just getting more Bernie-ized. But I'm looking going, you know, Massachusetts has done that, upper level. Look at the people moved out. And, of course, they all move into states like ours, and they forget why they left. But that's another story for another day, right?
Right.
All right. Is that redistribution of wealth?
Absolutely. It's just increasing the progressive. I mean, the United States has one of the most progressive tax systems in the world. That's not a political view. That's actually most economists will acknowledge that our both between Social Security, both the tax and the benefits, and of course our income tax makes it one of the most progressive in the world, which of course gets into innovation and wealth creation.
Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to, it's just interesting. We'll see where it goes. But, I don't know. It is what it is, right? I mean, Vermont's a funny state. The New York factor, when I was in college, you could feel it change. What is it? Still under a million people, right? About 700,000, is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. And less than 1% of them are in that upper bracket that the Vermont legislature wants to raise. The other thing they want to institute is some kind of a wealth tax. Which is not really a wealth tax per se, but they're trying to say, yeah, an out-of-stater, anyone with a significant presence in Vermont, will be liable for this tax. It's just amazing that that Montpelier thinks they can do this and people don't have options.
Yeah. All right, Doug Tangdon, thank you very much. World Market Advisors, thank you very much.
Jack, you have a great week.
Anna Brown, Citizens Count, citizenscount.org, nonpartisan, great source for local legislative stuff, joining us with a legislative wrap. Before we get to that, Anna, that second congressional district, the phones are burning among Democrats of who's going to jump in now that Ann Custer's not running for reelection in New Hampshire's second congressional district. I mean, heck, she's owned that seat, if you will, even though it's not hers to own, going back to Charlie Bass in 2012. And then on the Republican side, several names being floated. Let's start on that one, Anna. Good Monday morning, Anna Brown, Citizens Count, citizenscount.org.
Good morning. And yes, that was definitely a bombshell last week when Annie Custer said, that's it, not going to be running again. I think that it was pretty funny from my perspective. One of the first people that I saw come and say, wow, thank you, Representative Custer, for all your years of service was Colin Van Ostern, who, of course, has run for other state offices in the past. The funny thing was he had not posted for years. He emerged like a flower in spring, and sure enough, he's going to be running to replace her in that seat. So that is definitely a candidate that we have in. I've seen plenty of other names tossed around. Andrew Walensky, current state Senator Donovan Fenton, former state governor candidate Molly Kelly, and that's just on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, I've seen people talking about a relatively young Republican, Joe Sweeney. Lily Tang Williams, of course, is already running her race. She's very much involved. Bob Burns, or Robert Burns, has run for against Custer in the past. He's also considered runs for other offices, whether it's governor or a different state office. So that race, I think, is going to be huge. The thing is, though, that district is definitely more Democratic than the first district. It is much less competitive than the first district, which is seen as one of those very tight districts that could swing either way. So I think that really the primary in the second district might end up being a little more interesting than the general election, because if we get a lot of candidates jumping into an open race, that's when things can get spicy. And if it looks like, well, it's a pretty safe D district, then once again, it's going to be that primary that really determines what sort of candidates are moving forward.
Yeah, it's interesting because I am hearing different names. Not big surprises, but at least three or four on the Republican side. And ironically, maybe two or three or four on the Democrat side, beyond Colin Van Osten, beyond Andrew Walensky.
Yeah, I saw one list of that was just someone on Twitter was just compiling names they'd heard, and it was well over a dozen just on the D side. And I think if you go on the R side, we could probably come up with an equally long list. The interesting thing to remember as well is the second district, you know, is carved out. I would say you could say more Western New Hampshire, I suppose you could put it that way. But technically, you don't need to live in the district you run in. So this is theoretically a statewide pool of people that we could see jumping into the race.
And it is interesting. What about the legislative stuff? Because there are, and you talked about it last week, there are pending interesting dynamics of legislation, which ironically, I think, mimic a lot of the national topics.
Well, here's what was most interesting to me last week and then also going into this week. When we last spoke, I brought up that there were some really big housing bills that were coming up for a vote in the House, and they were really looking to push back against zoning restrictions at the local level. And I was waiting to see, okay, this is the moment. This appears to be a bipartisan issue, but New Hampshire has a really strong history of local control, not wanting the state to get involved. But sure enough, the House passed bills that would open up availability for accessory dwelling units, open up availability to build two-family houses on single-family lots, and block parking requirements that are stricter than one spot per unit. Granted, developers could still totally choose to offer many more spots per unit, but the towns could only say one spot per unit max. So that was really interesting to me that we saw all three of those go forward. And so this week, we're going to see a little bit of a similar debate happening on the Senate side. And in particular, there is a bill, SB 538, that is nicknamed the Homnibus Bill, which is a play on words for omnibus bill, a bill that combines a lot of different policies. And it's including things such as a tax credit to convert offices to residences, limits on lot sizes and parking requirements, changing inclusionary zoning to enable some higher density projects. And that came out of committee with a 4-1 vote in favor. So it looks like that will also be moving forward on the Senate side. So it really does seem that we're going to be getting some major pushback on local zoning coming out of the state legislature this year. But I still will keep my eye on the Senate, because it is not an issue that breaks down clearly on party lines when you're looking at changing up zoning.
Mm-hmm.
Also interesting, a few labor-related bills that are going to be coming up in the state Senate. Right to work. It probably will pass the Senate. It continues to not pass the House, so I'm not sure it will go further than the Senate, but that will still be a significant debate in the Senate this week. And then also there's another bill that I'm watching. It would rewrite the minimum and maximum amount of weekly unemployment benefits, and it came out of the Commerce Committee evenly split. But I think probably Republicans are going to vote it down. But I've seen growing debate around New Hampshire's unemployment taxes, unemployment benefits, the trust fund. And I think that's going to be an issue moving forward because those benefits were greatly expanded during COVID-19. Now they're back to normal, but the state hasn't changed them in a really long time, basically since the Great Recession. And the fund that funds unemployment is doing really healthy. We have record low unemployment right now. So there's an argument that we should change the benefits to reflect, you know, inflation and everything else. But how would that affect unemployment taxes going forward? What if we had a recession? New Hampshire's unemployment funding is much healthier than other states as well. So that's another factor to consider. Do we have a lot to play with, or do we not want to end up like other states that are, you know, potentially facing a crisis if we have another recession or COVID-19, you know, black swan event? So that debate, I think, a little wonky for sure, but I think for a lot of New Hampshire businesses, it's going to be interesting as it unfolds.
Interesting. Anything else? What about, we had one of our regular contributors who hosted for me on Friday, Alicia Presson-Xanthopoulos from the Seacoast Online, and she admittedly is on a government, you know, public affairs side working the pro-legalization of marijuana, but she seemed to think that this whole legalizing marijuana for greater recreational use is picking up steam in the Senate. Do you see that or not?
Here's the thing. Senator Daryl Abbas came to the House committee that was working on the bill and said, listen, I have a path forward. If you go with this state franchise model, we have the votes to pass this in the Senate. We can make it happen. It's the same sort of franchise model that Governor Sununu wants to see passed. Whether that will come out of the House or not, I don't know. Of course, once the Senate has the bill, they can make whatever changes they want to make. And then I think the House probably at this point would pass just about any version of legalization. The big change to me has not necessarily been what the Senate is saying, what Senator Daryl Abbas is saying. It's what Governor Sununu is saying. And I think that in some recent public events, he's definitely been a lot more vocal about, you know, let's get it done before the end of my term, basically. And that's the key, because in the past, it's been Governor Sununu really who I think has put a damper on the Senate saying, this is no good. I'm not going to sign it. And then the Senate says, well, why even move it forward? You know, it's much easier to oppose it then. So I would agree that there's definite momentum there.
All right. Good stuff. Anna Brown, you get a great week going Monday. Anna Brown, Citizens Count, citizenscount.org. Thank you, Anna.
Thanks, Jack.
The Granite State's number one streaming news talk station.
This is the Pulse of New Hampshire. Good morning, New Hampshire, powered by Sig Sauer. Now, back to Jack Heath on the Pulse of New Hampshire.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. You know, a lot of focus this week. You're going to see more on Baltimore after that incredible or amazing, unfortunate bridge collapse in the tanker. And number one's the cleaning of the packed tanker, if you saw any pictures of it. Number two is going to be the structural, try and, you know, clean up number one and then rebuilding how long, but also rerouting of, I think the fourth busiest port is Baltimore. And then, of course, other bridges. And I would say, Aaron, the people that are going to go to the bridge thing construction right away versus the navigation of tankers, that's a whole other subject. But take it away, Aaron.
Yes, this is a big one. So there are several bridges throughout the U.S. that have similar structural integrity to the Francis Scott Key Bridge, which fell in Baltimore a week ago tomorrow. There's two in Washington, one in Oregon. One is the San Francisco-Oakland Bridge in California, very popular. Golden Gate, arguably the most popular bridge in the U.S. George Washington Bridge connecting New York and New Jersey, wildly traveled every day. Verrazano Narrows Bridge. And then the Chesapeake Bay Bridge in Maryland, another really popular one. But what's interesting about these bridges is that they're suspension bridges. They're very, very tall, and they cover very large bodies of water. So essentially, each one has different levels of structural integrity and how sound it is, they all have the same fundamental structural support behind them. And if a large vessel plows into one of the pillars, it's coming down. So knowing that there's several other very important bridges that are navigable, how am I saying that word wrong?
Yep.
by the waterway, basically what you want to do is really avoid any potential vessel strike. And in order to do that, you absolutely need safeguards in place.
All right. Aaron Riel, NBC News Radio, national correspondent. Thank you. Thank you,
Aaron. Thanks, Jack.
Brad Card, Card & Associates. Brad, I'm sorry. I saw Scotty Scheffler nipped you a little bit, put you back on the back nine yesterday. PGA. Another.
Well, you're talking big time visitors. I thought when you were saying big, I was like Bobby Orr. Then you said music.
No, you know what, Brad? I know you and I are into golf. You're into probably a little more than me. But I love it when these first time or the 35 years old, 135 starts, you win a PGA tournament. Isn't that awesome? And you're basically playing with Scottie Scheffler.
Unbelievable. Yep. Cool.
All right. What about DC? Really cool. What are we missing? You know, Biden hitting the road.
We're in week two of recess, which is good because it gives everybody a chance to breathe. Because we're trying to, after getting through that debacle of appropriation mess that we had, and averting a government shutdown, which was pretty good.
Yeah.
So that was good. But hey, look, at you talked about the speaker. After passing that appropriation minibus, the last minibus, Marjorie Taylor Greene, I'm going to try to be kind, and I won't say the mean things about her that I would like to say. filed a motion to vacate, or is planning the motion to vacate. Evidently, has been having some conversations with the speaker for the speaker to try to alleviate that. This could not come at a worse time politically for Republicans, who are now trying to get into FY 2025 appropriations. And this is where the real work can come in, Jack. And Republicans in the House, my friends, need to remember that they do not control the Senate and they do not control the White House. And they're going to have a one-seat majority when they come back. So if you think that you're going to drive a hard right-wing agenda and actually get it through, you're crazy. Because it's just not reality. I prefer to live in reality. I get frustrated sometimes that there's not the legislation that we would like, the conservative legislation, but I live in a real world where Republicans did not win a big majority in the House. They have a single-seat majority, and they do not own the Senate or the White House. So this is just the political reality that we live in. And so you work to do the best that you can,
right,
and understand that you're not going to get everything that you want, but you try to get the most conservative bill that you can get given the circumstances. But for these people to think that they're going to drive a hard right-wing agenda is just not living in reality, and quite frankly sets them up for failure. And we shouldn't be talking about failure. There's a lot of good things that Republicans have been able to stop Democrats from doing. We ought to be talking about those things. Instead, we try to make it, the Freedom Caucus makes it look like Republicans are failing. And they're actually not failing. They've been able to accomplish some good things and prevent some good things, some bad things from happening. So we're going to have to wait and see what happens. Hopefully Marjorie Taylor Greene will not push the motion to vacate back in. Because we're not going to have a clear sign of a speaker anyway.
You know, Speaker Johnson, in this day and age, I actually think he's done a pretty masterful job, an artful job of balancing, because he does have some great oratory, presence, communication skills. And in this day and age, I mean, that's like an impossible. Just ask McCarthy. You know him well, Representative McCarthy. It's like absolute. That's like being a chef in a restaurant where no one is going to like what food you make, no matter how good you make it.
Look, what I think that the Speaker Johnson taking the role should be a lesson for a lot of the Freedom Caucus guys, because Speaker Johnson was a very conservative member, very, very conservative member, did not vote for continuing resolutions, was kind of a thorn in the side a little bit, and took a hard line. Well, now, as Speaker of the House, you realize you have to govern. And when you have to govern, you have to look at things a little bit differently. And I think I give the Speaker credit for recognizing that and for kind of being willing to work with folks to do the best thing for what's in the best interest of the country. It is not a fiscally responsible thing to shut the government down. People may think so. It costs the government billions of dollars if we have to be shut down. So it's not the prudent thing to do. I'm glad the speaker has recognized that and has worked hard to find bills, prevent a lot of really bad stuff from getting in the bills. So I give him a lot of credit, and he's kept the government open, which is a good thing. And now they can begin a real appropriation process, and hopefully we'll have more regular order so people can file amendments and they can be voted on. But if you file an amendment and is voted on and you lose that amendment, you can't just say, I want to take my ball and go home. That's not the responsible thing to do. Right. Because many of these agenda items, they're not going to pass the House.
Yep.
A lot of Republicans won't even vote for them.
We're up against it.
They just need to recognize that.
All right, Brad Card, Card & Associates Live. Catch you tomorrow. Thanks, Brad. Rory O'Neill, NBC News Radio national correspondent, although I think some people are already calling to hold a minute on the contest. We haven't announced who it is yet. Is that Rory? Okay. Going to go to Rory, who's not a contestant to win these concert tickets. Then we'll open up the our GM&H phone lines and take a winner. Rory, good morning. Housing market conditions. The cost of making a down payment is up in the United States. In fact, it used to be about, going back years, this will date myself, 15 to 20, 30 grand. Now what I'm hearing, Rory, oftentimes it's $100,000 or more for that minimum down payment. And a lot of younger people trying to break into the housing market, even if they find a home, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, they're turning to kind of parents to help them with the down payment. Take it away, Rory.
Yeah, they are. So a Redfin report now shows that the median down payment, so half or above, half or below this number, the median down payment is $55,640. That was the number for February. That's up 24% from just a year ago. Now, they're looking at pretty much the typical home buyer's down payment last month equal to about 15% of the purchase price of a home. They're upping their down payments because they want to reduce that monthly payment with these higher interest rates. And then the other report out today comes from Bankrate that says these are the salaries that you need in order to buy a home in states. Now, 22 states, you need a household income in excess of $100,000 a year in order to afford a basic home.
Yeah.
So the median price, $402,000 for the home, $110,000 median income is the number. I can look at the New Hampshire numbers, by the way, just if you're curious.
Oh, it's probably at least that.
$130,000 is the number they suggest for New Hampshire. What's interesting, that's the January 2024 number. But if you go back just 4 years, it was $84,000. So $84,000 four years ago in New Hampshire, $130,000 today.
Yeah, I mean,
that's more than a 50% increase in just 4 years.
And you wonder when this is going to change or the bottom drop out and things adjust. And I talk to people that say they're not sure it is. This might be the new norm for a year or two. I don't know.
Look, we are still well behind on housing inventory. They are catching up when it comes to multifamily homes, but single family homes, especially those starter homes, are nearly impossible to find out there because home builders aren't making them because there's more profit in the higher end home. And then local zoning laws are also making it pretty tough to put more developments in.
And Rory, what about Florida where you are?
So the income number was interesting. So 4 years ago, the Bankrate said you needed $73,000 a year for income in Florida. Now they're saying you need $114,000.
Wow, more inventory, but still a lot of demand.
Yep, cheap Florida, but all, you know, that just shows you that Florida ain't the cheap alternative it used to be.
No, that's why I'm here in other states now. A lot of people are migrating. What, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina,
South Carolina. Yep. Yeah, it's like I'm telling you, you know, plastics from The Graduate. Yeah,
You wait a minute. Well, you just threw that in there, and I Dustin Hoffman floating around the pool. I know that movie well.
There you go. Yeah, so that's my version of plastics. South Carolina.
All right. Thank you, Rory. Good stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, Jack.
Always Mondays wouldn't be Monday without some good news at the end. Tom Raffio, President and CEO of Northeast Delta Dental, Delta Dental Radio on weekends, and stories from the Starting Line book. And the addendums with all the other runners. Tom, on a Monday with some good news. How are you?
Good morning, and I love the national anthem. I used to specifically listen at the noon hour for it. Now it's at 11:45 or so. So excellent. And I also enjoyed your interview with Eric. I mean, definitely he has leading a very important topic, drug addiction, and alcoholism and mental health. So that was, I think you do important work by having an interview like that. So thank you. On the front fun stuff, we had a race Saturday here at Delta Dental, a fundraiser for the Dana-Farber Cancer Center. We have a runner several runners in New Hampshire doing the Boston Marathon, including my wife, but one of the runners in particular, Beth Conley, who's actually done like 100 marathons in her career, uses this 5K to help her raise funds for Dana-Farber. because you know a lot of runners raise money for charities who do the Boston Marathon, and I think that's the little known aspect of the Boston Marathon. Obviously, it's the most prestigious marathon in the world, but millions of dollars have been raised for all sorts of charities, not just Dana-Farber, over the years, and I don't think people, you know, realize, you know, that type of connection. I know you do, Jack, but some people just look at it as an athletic event, but it's actually turned into, you know, a huge fundraising event for all worthwhile charities. And that's why we get involved, Delta Dental, in sponsoring road races, because generally there's an intersection with, you know, a charity. So, for example, the Delta Dental Mount Washington Road Race raises money for the Colores County Family Health Center, which now is a dental center because of their funds raised through that race. And Jack, I want to, if you don't mind, may I talk about a birthday party?
Yes.
So it was the birthday party last Thursday. I was at the State House with hundreds of legislators and other oral health stakeholders, and we had the one-year birthday, technically it's today, of the Adult Dental Medicaid program. So we brought the legislators up to speed, and it was really celebratory. So in this kind of world where, you know, there's so much noise and it's hard to turn on the news now, this was definitely a bipartisan effort. You had Senator Jeb Bradley and Senator Cindy Rosenwald really championing it from a Senate perspective, and we had leaders in the House as well on both sides of the aisle. Representative Edwards, for example, and then the state is Dr. Sarah Finney, really works with me closely. So it's going well, and we just need to continue to get dentists to sign up. But in the meantime, we every weekend except this past weekend because it was Easter, we have the mobile dental clinic at different spots around the state. And we'll talk later in the week, but this coming weekend, this is my running friends, just a reminder, it's the beginning of the Capital Era Race Series, and the first race is called the SCA 5K, and that's going to be on Sunday. And the book, Stories from the Starting Line, is going well. All money goes to Veterans Oral Health, and people are rebuying it, if you will, because of the additional chapter that you referenced, because we originally had 60 runners in the book. Now we have 90. So people, we added a chapter, and that's the beauty of working with Amazon. You can add a chapter, and quickly get it out to the bookstores like Gibson's and the bookery. So that's the story, Jack. For my veterans friends, just give me a call, 223-1300. If you don't qualify for the VA or if you don't qualify for Medicaid, and we've been having, Mitch and I have been addressing probably between 5 and 10 a week over the past couple months. So I think there's a need, and I want to give a shout out to my board who allowed me to allocate $300,000, you know, for this program. And I thank you, Jack, for calling it to my my attention. So thank you.
Good stuff, Tom. Hey, you might be able to get out one more time midweek on the snow. Thank you, Tom.
Will do. Take care. Bye.